No is a hard stop. Yes and leads to possibility. So that's step number one.
All right, gang, what's up? This is Future Proof, episode number 156, to be exact. I'm your host, Bill Sheridan. As always, glad you're here, glad to be here. And no, by the way, it's not your imagination. It has been a while since we've done one of these things, and it's my fault, completely my fault. I took some vacation time, God forbid. So I haven't done the podcast in a while, and no, I'm not going to apologize for it, okay? My wife and I took a vacation, actually, to Napa, California, I guess as opposed to, say, Napa, Iowa, or something. Yes, Napa Valley. It had been actually about 14 years since we took a vacation together, just the two of us, right? We've been on plenty of other vacations, family things, but always with a bunch of other people, right? But just the two of us, way too long it had been, and neither of us had taken any time off since before the pandemic. So we were due, and here's what we did, okay? Are you ready for this? You better be sitting down. Are you sitting down? Because this stuff will blow your mind, okay? Every day we woke up on our own, mind you, no alarms, just whenever the hell we felt like it. Then we just kind of laid there for a while, trying to decide what to do. Then we'd get up, you know, get dressed, go get some coffee, some breakfast, just kind of walk around town, check things out. Cool little town, by the way, Napa, California. And then we came back to the hotel, read the paper, read a book, did nothing until it was time for our first wine tasting of the day. So we'd go do that, which, let's face it, you know, we're drinking wine before 1 p.m. So how bad can the day be, really, right? And then we'd go do a little shopping, maybe a little sightseeing, go back to the hotel, maybe take a nap, get up, go to dinner at a Michelin-rated restaurant, mind you. So really, really good dinner. Then back to the hotel and sleep. And we did that each day, every day, for 5 days. So that's right. Our vacation consisted, in order of importance, of sleeping, wine tasting, eating, and shopping. You know, sometimes we didn't even shop. So sometimes we just did the other three, but that's it. It was like Disney World for adults, man, and it was awesome. So no, I'm not going to apologize for taking some time off. Had a great time, very relaxed time, but I'm back now, ready to roll with some all new episodes. So buckle in, because this stuff is going to be thoroughly good. First, let's start with this, okay? This week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So, now that vacation is out of the way, what should we talk about? This week we're going to talk about comedy and how it relates to business, because it does. It absolutely does. And my guest this week is going to tell us how. His name is Peter Margaritis. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know Peter. He's been with us a couple of times before. This time he's with us because he's got a new book out. It's called Off Script: Mastering the Art of Business Improv. And what do we mean when we talk about business improv? Well, that's what we're going to talk about this week. interestingly enough, right? Improv, that's that whole notion of yes and, right? Of building a conversation out of what the other person says, not out of our own agendas, which is really, really hard to do, right? I mean, in our business settings, most of us want to control the narrative, right? We want to ensure ideal outcomes. We want to script the conversations and manage the problems and predict what's going to happen. And most importantly, win, right? We want to win negotiations or new business or market share. But what if good leaders could become better leaders by doing the opposite, right? By letting go of the control and going off script in their conversations and negotiations. By merely being present in the conversation and working to collaborate with others in authentic, you know, really kind of empathetic ways. That would be pretty freaking amazing, right? It would be amazing because it almost never happens. I mean, think about how most conversations go, right? The other person starts talking, and as soon as they start talking, you start thinking, okay, now I've got to come up with something good to say when they stop talking. So what am I going to say? And then you start crafting a response while the other person is still talking. And so that means you're not really listening to anything they're saying, right? You're just planning your own story in your head. And the only thing, in fact, the only thing you're listening for is for the other person to stop talking, because that's your cue that you can start telling your story, right? And round it goes. We're all just telling our own stories. Nothing ever really gets communicated. But what if you could actually communicate with the other person in a way that accomplishes something, whether it's collaboration or understanding or negotiation or just, you know, kind of real, genuine human connection? We can do it. We just need some of the tips that my guest this week, Peter Margaritis, offers in his new book. And right at the top of this idea of becoming, a better communication is this notion of becoming better listeners, right? To actually focus intently on the words that are coming out of the other person's mouth rather than just trying to craft our responses while they're talking, to respond to what they're saying rather than what we want to say, right? So there's this other great book out there called Getting Past No, Negotiating in Difficult Situations. It's by a guy named William Urey. He's the director of the Global Negotiation Project at Harvard University. And here's what he has to say about the art of listening. He writes, quote, "Too often, negotiations proceed as follows. Party A sets out their opening position. Party B is so focused on figuring out what to say that they don't really listen. And when Party B's turn comes to lay out their position, Party A thinks, well, they didn't respond to what I said. They must not have heard me. I'd better repeat it. And then Party B concludes that they too have not been properly heard. So they repeat their position, and on it goes, right? What William Urey calls a dialogue of the deaf. Everything has been said before, says a character in a novel by Andre Gide. And since nobody listens, we have to keep going back and beginning all over again. You have an opportunity to interrupt the chorus of monologues if you are willing to be the first to listen." And again, William Urey here in his book, he writes, quote, "Listening to someone may be the cheapest concession you can make. We all feel a deep need to be understood. By satisfying that need, you can help turn the negotiation around. Listening requires patience and self-discipline. Instead of reacting immediately or plotting your next step, you have to remain focused on what your counterpart is saying. Listening offers a window into the other side's thinking. It gives you a chance to engage them in a cooperative task, that of understanding their problem, right? It makes them more willing to listen to you. Once you have heard the other person out, they will most likely become less reactive, more rational, and more responsive to problem-solving negotiation," end quote. And that's what Peter Margaritis means about business improvisation, right? It's about saying yes to what you're hearing the other person say and moving the conversation forward rather than just saying what you want the other person to hear, right? So that's what he and I are going to talk about this week. Now, Peter and I are old friends. We go back a ways. We're both big sports fans. So you're going to hear a little bit of that banter at the beginning here, but that's just a little bit more improvisation, right? A way of easing into the conversation. So, it was a pleasure catching back up with Peter Margaritis. And again, I think this is a really important conversation. This is a skill that too few of us have really truly mastered. So pleased to have with me back on the podcast once again, my friend. He's a CPA also, fellow sports fan. Here is my conversation with Peter Margaritis.
There he is, the man, the myth, the legend.
Peter Margaritis, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you there, Mr. Sheridan? Barry Sanders signed jersey?
That's a signed Barry Sanders jersey.
What? That wasn't
with letter of authenticity attached to the back.
Wow.
That was a Christmas gift from my wife and my father-in-law kind of went in halves on that. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's
nice.
One of my prized possessions. So.
Absolutely.
How are you? I also have Reds ticket signed by Pete Rose.
Oh,
well, although that's in my opinion has decreased significantly in value over the years. So
absolutely. my only memorabilia that I cherish is a ball signed by the 73 Reds. Everybody on
by
the
all
team.
Of them. Wow,
by all of them.
That's awesome. My father-in-law got me this too. It's a little kind of a toy catcher's mask.
Oh yeah,
but signed by Johnny Bench. I don't know if you can see that up there on the side.
Yeah,
there
it is. Yeah.
Kind of cool.
I have my neighbor is a collector of a lot of this stuff, and he's got some of that Reds memorabilia, and I just told him, don't ever turn your alarm off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it might disappear.
Yeah, I think those are the only two Reds signatures I have. I used to, when I was a kid, I used to have a baseball card. It was when he was with the Mets, but it was signed by Tom Seaver.
Seaver, yeah.
I don't ever know what became of that. I used to do that all the time. Like that was back in the day where you could literally like take a baseball card, put it in an envelope, address it to Tom Seaver, New York Mets, and ask for a signature, and they would sign it and send it back to you in the mail.
Wow!
And that doesn't happen anymore. But
I don't rarely say this, but man, I do some things about the good old days I do miss.
Oh man, I tell you. The worst mistake I ever made was I had a baseball signed by Mickey Mantle.
What?
Like I sat in front of the man and watched him sign it.
Uh-huh.
This is again when I was a kid in Little League. And then out playing ball, and I'd lost like my last ball. And I'd like, I needed another ball. So I I went and got the Mickey Mantle ball, and that one went out in the field somewhere too. And I don't ever know what happened to that one, but I kick myself every day. But I needed a ball,
It was like, needed a ball. Yeah, I'm sure I can get another one from Mickey. It's not that big a deal.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But, you do what you have to do when you're a kid like that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations on the new book. This is kind of, it was unexpected for me. I didn't know you were working on one, but this is great.
I needed to do something during the pandemic, and I'd taken care of a lot of other stuff I had planned. I went, well, I might as well just start writing this book that everybody kept telling me I needed to write. And, writing a book is fun. It's challenging. It's a pain in the ass. But this one, I am super excited about. I think I have found the myth buster to all things improv. And I don't know if you had a chance to read a little bit of what I sent you this morning on a late notice.
I have not. So okay. I'm looking forward to it. So I'm coming into this cold, but I know you, and I know a bit about where you're coming from with this stuff. So let's talk a little bit about it. So it's called Off Script.
Right.
Mastering the Art of Business Improv. So I think we all kind of have a flavor of what improv is. Tell me, how do you define business improv?
Well, it's really no different than what they do on the stage. It's just focused in a different direction. The application of yes and, the application of listening, being present, respect, trust, support, adapting to a changing landscape, that all happens in successful improv comedy. It's also what we need to do in business. And it's just taking that, what I've learned through theatrical workshops and just go, okay, well, then this can apply in these scenarios, in these situations, in business. Mm-hmm. But the big myth is, oh, this stuff is just made up. You're just winging it. You're not coming prepared. And improv is just the exact opposite of that. And I'll save the hook. I'll save the big hooks when we ask, we get to that point. But we over-prepare most of the time. Now, if we're going into a brainstorming session, differently, we'll come with ideas and thoughts and grabbing at things that we know about. Mm-hmm. But there's not that script there. So that's important.
That script is the big thing. I don't know if that's what you were talking about here, but when I hear you say we over-prepare, that's what I usually think of is, we come to an interview or a meeting or whatever with all these notes and all these things that we've got to get out and these thoughts that we got, these brilliant ideas that we have to share with everybody else. And we're so busy and concerned about when can I interject this or, say that, and we're not in the moment and we're not interacting and engaging with other people. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes. That's exactly what we're saying. I mean, you could be a CEO of an organization and you're delivering the annual meeting and you've got a script. And you can look, as you're delivering the script, you can look out to the audience and see if they're paying attention to you or not. Mm. Your goal is not to have them, do the what I call the conference prayer, take out the phone and bow their heads.
Right.
You want to inspire them. So if you're seeing this, you better have something that you can adapt. I hate that word pivot. Almost said it. to incorporate into that in your prepared remarks is to move those pieces out and bring other stuff in that might be that should be more inspirational. And speaking from the heart, not just from a prepared speech.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what's I think I know the answer to this, mm-hmm. just based on what I've read about your book, but what's the first step in this? It almost sounds to me like the first step is to just shut your mouth and listen to what the other person is saying.
That's a good way of putting it. There's a lot in this first step. One is adopting the yes and philosophy mindset. Mm-hmm. No's acceptable, but there's different ways that we can get to that. But if we come in with yes and, I'm listening to you, I'm respecting your opinion, tell me more, let's have a conversation, versus no, it's not in the budget, and it shuts the conversation down. Two, it's parking that ego and really being committed to listening. And Alan Alda's got a great quote, which I'm completely going to butcher. But basically, he says, when we're truly listening, we're accepting the fact that I might change my opinion mm-hmm. or my mind. People say that they listen, but no, I've got biases. There's no way I'm going to listen to this person because I don't believe anything they have to say, but I'm going to tell people I listened to them. No, you may have listened, but you didn't hear, you didn't absorb, you didn't, take something into consideration that might be completely opposite of your belief, and at least try to understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's easier said than done. It's a culture that can be created, and it goes to the fact of, have you heard this? How do you eat an elephant?
Yeah, one bite at a time, right?
One bite at a time. This isn't, I read that somewhere, I don't know where it was, and I'd never heard of it during the pandemic. I love that. Mm-hmm. Because if you eat an elephant, I'm going to do incorporate whole culture, you're going to throw it up, it's going to be a disgustful, distasteful experience, you'll never want to do it again. But if you take one bite at a time, over time, you will start seeing change. And but you've got to be consistent in this application. And that pick and choose and be mindful that you will fail. You will revert to your old ways. You just have to be cognizant of that and go, oh no, I got to get back on the wagon.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it, I mean, and it all comes, I mean, you know, as we're talking about this idea of listening, I heard a phrase, active listening, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is putting aside what you expect to hear, mm-hmm. and just actively hearing what the other person is saying, right? And formulating thoughts about what you're going to say in response to what you're hearing. In other words, it seems to me that a lot of what we call listening is just us waiting to say what we want to say, right? I hear you, but I'm not actually listening to the words that are coming out of your mouth. I'm thinking about how am I going to respond, right? And right. And this is more nuanced. This is kind of a harder thing, but it leads to better engagement, it seems to me.
In improv, we call it listening to understand versus listening to respond. Mm-hmm. Listening to understand is parking your ego, getting rid of all the distractions, internal and external, and just having a conversation with the other person and trying to keep our emotions in check and just trying to understand where they are coming from. And the art of listening to understand, the art of active listening, is a way of showing appreciation to the other person you're speaking with. Listening to respond is you describe it. I'm just waiting to pounce on and tell you what I think without listening to you, or the art of interrupting.
Mm, there you go. Yep.
And I, you know, we all interrupt. I work on it, been working on it. I fail at times. I'm better than most.
Well, yeah. We all do it.
We all do it. And I ask people, so how do you feel when somebody interrupts you? Do you like it? No. Then why are you doing it to other people?
Right.
Because I've got something that I need to say. Well, keep it in there. Or if you're like me, write just a note down or something so you remember what you want, how to respond. But let the person finish. Because a lot of times the most important thing that is being said comes at the end of the sentence. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a punchline in a joke. You don't put the punchline in the middle. You wait till the end, the power of that sentence to get the impact.
That's right. That's right. And I have to say, I normally when I do these interviews, I come prepared with a list of questions that I want to ask. Mm-hmm. I didn't do this time because of this very conversation. I was like, I want to be in the moment with you. So
That's how I conduct my podcast. I come in with maybe one question that I'm thinking about, but I look at it, two guys, two individuals having coffee and right. just having a conversation and listening and seeing where the conversation takes us.
Well, all that said, how does that relate to business? What are the benefits for business people, business leaders, to be engaged in this way, to come, you know, less prepared, quote unquote, but more engaged?
One, we're listening to the audience, not listening to what we've written. We're hearing what the audience is telling us. And if we take something in today's times right now, there's a lot. I mean, there's a phenomenon going on in this country. There's a group of people who don't want to go back to the office. Mm-hmm. But they're being forced to go back to the office. And those who are being forced to go back to the office are quitting in droves without another job. Versus, and there's organizations out there who are polling their employees, what do you want to do? Do you want to come back? Do you want to stay home? Do you want to do a hybrid model and incorporating what they want? By doing that, you've got more buy-in from the masses versus you've got turnover.
Right.
And I, if you listen, now everybody's not, there's a story about a woman, her last name was Mulcahy, who took over Xerox in 2000 when it was hemorrhaging blood, hemorrhaging dollars. And there's a lot of pressure on her to get the stock price back up, to get cash flow in the right direction. And basically she said, I'm going on a listening tour. I'm spending 3 to 6 months going out into the field and listening to our stakeholders on what they think the issues are. And then I'm bringing that information back to the incubator. We're going to design something based off of their feedback, and we're going to implement it. And when they did, and when her team did, and they went back into the field to tell them, we listened to you. Now, all ideas we couldn't take in, some of them weren't going to work, but what we got from you, we were able to build this in hopes of riding the ship, and it did. Versus, I'm going to sit up here in my ivory tower and I'm going to tell you what you need. That's that old 70s, 80s, 60s, 50s leadership style. I'm going to tell you.
Well, and I think Tom Hood had a phrase for it. We've gone from a time where leadership was all about command and control,
right,
to a time when it's all about collaborate and communicate. Mm-hmm. And interact with one another.
And that's what improv is.
Yeah. So I read this book. It's called, it's about negotiation. It's called Getting Past No. Mm-hmm. It's by William Ury. And it's all about negotiation and some skills that you have to learn about becoming a better negotiator. But one of the things that he says that I think kind of applies to this is that one of the steps in negotiation is agree. Mm-hmm. Right? And he puts it this way: get as many yeses into the room as you possibly can, right? No matter what the conversation is or how it's going. And I'm looking at some notes here from a presentation that I give. So you're talking with your boss about you want to try something new, and the boss says, no, we can't do that. It can't possibly work. Then he says, the next question you ought to ask is something along the lines of, are you saying that you don't see how my proposal can possibly work? Is that what you're saying? Now, what's he going to say? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Your proposal can never work. And that sounds like a bad thing, but there's a yes in the room, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of opens the door for more dialogue and for it's a window for you to explain how it could work. Or maybe if this particular way can't work, what are some other ways that we can, it's just every yes in the room is a positive. Right. As opposed to a negative, and it just kind of drives the conversation forward. And I see a lot of parallels between that particular point of negotiation and what you're saying.
There's an exercise that we can do during the interview, and I don't know if we're in the interview now or not, because I know we started recording.
Yeah, we're rolling, man.
So. Okay, we're rolling. so let's play this little game. Okay. I just want you to say yes.
Okay. Yes.
Just say yes. Now give it to me. Like, yes.
Yeah.
So do you want to tell a story with me?
Sure. Yes.
No, yes.
Yes.
After each question, you answer yes. Yes. Is this a story about a man named Jed?
Named Jeb?
Jed.
Yes. Jed. Yes.
Yes. Was he a poor mountaineer and he barely kept his family fed?
Yes.
And then one day he was out hunting critters and shot at one.
Yes.
And did up from the ground come oil?
Yes.
Is that called bubbling crude?
Yes.
Texas tea?
Yes.
Okay, cool. All right, great job. All right, now we're going to do it again. But this time we're going to take yes out and put in no.
Okay.
Do you want to tell a story with me?
No. Period.
I got nothing.
Yeah. Yep.
You can have 1,000 yeses, but that one no can shut it all down.
Yep.
And I like what you were talking about, because the person tried to shut that conversation down with the no, but they responded in a way to get the yes and try to build on the yes. But yes leads to possibilities. Yes leads to a journey. Yes leads to excitement. So I will let you in on the little piece of hook now that I know that we are recording.
Yep.
And if there's a little preface there. Did you know that Martin Luther King improvised the I Have a Dream speech?
I didn't know that.
Most people don't.
Like the entire thing or?
No, a piece of it.
Okay.
Okay. So the story goes that the night before he was to deliver this speech in Washington in 63, he and his internal group were working on the speech. And King was methodical when he would write his sermons. He was methodical, 15, 18 hours, memorization. There was one time in his life where he had to improvise, and it was soon after Rosa Parks got arrested that people came to him and wanted him to comment on it, and he only had 20 minutes. So he couldn't spend that time, but he saw those words that were coming from the heart, just coming out of him. You know, was one of his best speeches of his life, as it has been written. So during the speech, he gets about two-thirds the way through, and you can watch the video. And he's looking down, reading. He's wanting to have an impact like the Gettysburg Address. He's wanting, but he's also wanting the audience to participate in the conversation. And they're not. He's not getting that feedback that he anticipates. But two-thirds of the way through, he kind of stops. And there's a gospel singer named Mahalia Jackson who's behind him, said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin."
Mm-hmm.
And he hears this, and what has been written is he takes his script and pushes aside. And, oh, by the way, did I mention that he'd been doing the I Have the Dream speech for the past 6 months? It was originally in his prepared speech, but they pulled it out because they thought they overused it. So he pushes it away because he looked down and he said, these words in his mind aren't working, and just re-encountered the I Have a Dream speech. The speech is original title is Normalcy, Never Again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he had that knowledge. He had that practice. He had that, you know, it wasn't something just off the cuff. But when Mahalia said that and knew that and brought that in, and actually one of the people that was in the crowd went, uh-oh, these people don't know, but that they're about ready to go to church. Now, there's a retired judge in Cleveland, Patricia Blockman, who has done the I Have a Dream speech three times with the Cleveland Orchestra. A colleague knows of her, put her in contact with me, and I interviewed her on Zoom. She validated a lot of these stories, but she also asked me, "PD, have you ever been to a black church?" I said, "No, I haven't. I really want to." She goes, "Well, here's what goes on in a black church. The reverend, the minister, wants the congregation to communicate back with him during the sermon. He wants the amens, the hallelujahs, the hands, all of that. And when they don't get that, they will go off script." And she goes, "I believe that's exactly what Martin Luther King did that day, because he wasn't getting that from that audience." Mm-hmm. They were completely off script. So the original title of this book was Improv for the C-Suite. And I went back as I was rereading, I went, no. An idea that was given to me by Jeffrey Hazlett, C-Suite, about shortening the title, I said, off script. That's what this is all about, the ability, the confidence, and the courage to go off script, to get comfortable with the uncomfortable, and deliver it from the heart.
So, I mean, from a business perspective, what happens when we do that? When we go off script, when we dare to... you know, make those connections and mm-hmm. say yes and take the conversation right. to that place. What right. happens from a business perspective?
Well, if you've never done it before, it will be very scary, honestly, seriously. But I think more business leaders can learn how to have a backup plan in case they're not getting what they think they're going to get. Because it's all about watching the audience. It's not about, it's about how am I connecting with the audience? And if this doesn't work, I can take this out and put this in. By the way, that's what professional speakers do too. When you've got an hour-long gig, and next thing you know, it's cut to 20 minutes, what can I take out and still have that impact? And that's where a lot of that training comes from. But be willing to adapt to a different dialogue when you're not getting the response. And this goes to those who present CPE. Yeah, I've sat through enough talks. I've sat through enough, and the audience is clearly bored to death, but they're up there just driving through to get all that content in there with no story, no nothing, with no impact. So business leaders can do it, but it takes training. It takes faith. Some are better than others.
Well, it seems to me that like when you kind of dare to go there, things that you weren't expecting start to happen. Like new ideas gosh, you know, I was given a presentation not too long ago, and we went to Q&A, which is like the danger zone for every public speaker, right? It's like, that's completely off script.
Right.
And the guy raised his hand and he asked a question and I had no idea what he was talking about. So I said, could you give me an example of what you're talking about? And he gave me an example and I started asking questions of him, right? It initially started with him asking me a question, and then we started asking questions back and forth. And in the process of asking those questions, we started arriving at, I don't know if it was an answer, but it was an idea that got him closer to where he wanted to be. So I don't know. It seems like things start to happen in weird and really cool ways when you decide to ditch the script and just have a conversation.
And let go of that control. We have a lot of, in our journey through life and through business, we have a lot of stories. We have a lot of instances that happen. And if we can remember to write those instances down in a place that and revisit that story journal, whatever, revisit those stories, because at some point in time you may need to call upon something from 2 years ago that would fit here better and be more inspirational than what I've already planned. Now when I do a presentation, I go in completely overprepared. I walk in the room, I metaphorically take it and throw it away, and I'm playing off of the audience. And will I cover everything? I don't know. Will I cover most of it? Yes. Will it be exact? Absolutely not. You can see me do a presentation on this topic, and each presentation will be just a little bit different because of the audience, what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, what I can apply, maybe help to make that point a little bit better, because I'm focused on them more than I'm trusting this in my preparation in order to have an imperfect presentation. Because as you well know, we deliver our presentations, they're not 100% flawless. They're not perfect.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, when you said you come to each presentation over-prepared, right? But the purpose of, like, you don't come to present everything you know. You come to have that as supporting material for the conversation that you're going to have with the folks who they're in the room.
Absolutely.
That seems to me to be the difference between, an okay presentation and one that's really kind of illuminating and generates new ideas.
Absolutely. And the audience knows when they're seeing something completely different than they're accustomed to. And they start to lean in. And they start to participate in this conversation that we're having. And this can go to a staff meeting. This can go to, CEO delivering information to the masses. This can go to, speaking in front of 1,000 people. Anytime we're in front of somebody else other than when we're, it takes two people to have an audience.
Right.
That audience can be one. And we forget about that, but that audience can be one, and that audience can be 1,000. If we keep that mindset of I need to play off the audience more than I need to play off what I prepared, as long as I am prepared and I trust my instincts. Have I failed? Yes, in doing this at times. When you first start off, you do. You tend to then, I'm kind of rambling. Now I need to bring it back. But I'm the only one who knows that I may have failed. The audience kind of doesn't. They're just sitting there going, what is happening? This is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
We're having this interactive conversation, and for some strange reason, I feel like he's actually listening to all of us.
Yeah,
it's fun when you're in the moment. It's fun when you're present, and you're in for this journey, this ride that you have no idea where it's going to go, but something magical can happen at the end. And that's the coolest part of this.
That is very cool. I mean, you know, it's going to be a weird kind of tangent that I'm going on here, but it reminds me of, I forget when I read or heard his interview with somebody, but it was Bruce Springsteen, of all people, talking about his live performances, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes out, and of course he knows all the songs, right?
Right.
He can play them rote from start to finish. That part is the easy part. But what he's doing is he's looking at the crowd and looking at faces in the crowd, mm-hmm. and trying to find a connection. Who are the people who are really engaged? Who are going to feed me as much as I'm feeding
right.
them?
Right.
And so that we can have this really powerful moment together. And that's what he's looking for. And he'll adjust his set list based on the feedback that he's getting in the moment from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, it's a weird kind of segue there, but I think I think it's kind of the same thing, you know.
That's improvisation, and you know, Bill, we all are improvisers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your daughter Molly is how old now?
Oh gosh, she just turned 19.
That's what I thought. So go back 19 years ago when you and your wife were bringing her home.
Mm-hmm.
I said this to my wife at the time we were bringing Stephen home. Oh, did we forget the manual?
Yeah,
there's no manual. There's no script.
We start making it up from moment one.
Right. We start trying to figure it out from moment one. And part of that moment may have been stuff that we had read leading up to that point. Or if we don't remember it, we get on the phone with our parents or the neighbor who has 30 kids or whatever, and we start asking questions to find the answer in order to solve the problem.
Yeah.
We were all improvisers. Have you ever come into work one day and you had a to-do list all ready to go, and by the time you left, you have not checked off one item on that to-do list? Improvised.
Yep. So, all right. So, people who may not consider themselves great at improv, which I'm guessing is most of us. I mean, where do we start? I mean, you know, how do we get better at this? And, you know, can you boil it down to like one or two things that we can work on now just to start building that muscle?
Well, the first thing you can do, and the easiest / the hardest thing, is to listen to your vocabulary. See how many times you say no. Because, or yes, but, and can you shift that to yes, and it's not yes, and you still stink. No, it's not yes, and I'm still not going to do this.
Right.
It's yes. Yes, and is about agreement, but not always agreeing. Yes, and is the willingness to listen, to maybe have my ideas changed. And just start that, see if you can insert that into your vernacular when you're having conversations. When you feel the no coming up, yes, and can you explain to me why this would be a good idea for me in my career? Versus no, there's no way I'm going to speak for free. And just because no, I got nothing. No is a complete sentence.
No is a hard stop, isn't it?
It's like no is a hard stop. Yes, and leads to possibilities. So that's step number one. Step number two, shameless plug, buy my book. Read it. Buy my first book, Improv is No Joke. Read it. Mm-hmm. And three, get outside your comfort zone and find an improv workshop near you that you can take an introductory class for 6 weeks. And another shameless plug, during the pandemic, I created a virtual improv workshop that I wasn't going to do it over the summer. Like, who wants to be inside during the summer when we've been inside already for like a year, year and a half? So I'm relaunching this here in October. And just go in with an open mind. And you know what? When I first, I write in the book, when I first went to, I was doing stand-up. I went to this improv workshop. They were doing this crazy stuff. What am I doing here? I thought about bailing out on it. And then the instructor said, okay, next week's homework is study the 70s. I went, oh, there was homework. Well, that's why I'm a fish out of water. So I did what he said and came back in that next week and participated in these activities. And you know what? I was funny. Mm-hmm. Those who didn't do the homework, they absolutely suck.
Yeah.
Then the big light went on. I went, oh my God, this is about being funny, but this has a lot more to do with it.
It's not about what I know. It's about what we can do together. Right.
Right. And it's all about, yeah. And that's another thing about improv. It's all about the team. It's not about me. It's not about, you're a football fan. You remember when Bruce Arians and the Cardinals were playing the Seahawks and it ended in a tie in overtime at 3-3.
Yeah.
And Bruce Arians basically threw his kicker under the bus. We pay you to kick the ball through the uprights. That's your job. You didn't do your job today. Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll goes, hey, he's my guy. He got us at least 3-3. It just wasn't his day, but love the guy. You know,
Yeah, the game didn't come down to that one kick. There were a whole lot of other stuff going on there.
Right.
It didn't involve that kicker, right?
It's right, like, right. And he didn't, he may have like given him a hard time or chewed him out, not in public, but right. He didn't throw him under the bus.
Right.
Because it's all about the team. And how do I make the team better? It's not me, the leader. I take the blame. I love it when leaders take the blame and don't pass that blame on to their teammates, especially in public. And I love it when they give the praise to the team for such a great job that they did. A lot of leaders don't do that because their ego gets in the way.
The good ones do. And that's right. That's what this is all about. So tell the book comes out when?
Book comes out, scheduled to be released on October 6th. Now, building a book, going through the editing process, it's like building a house. Sure. We may have some rain delays, but we're really shooting for that October 6th release of it. But we're taking pre-orders now.
Awesome. We'll keep an eye out for it. Gosh, as always, Peter, It's a ton of fun and a pleasure to speak with you every time we get together. So thanks for taking the time. Congratulations on the new book. Thanks for the insights. I appreciate you being here.
Oh, thanks, man. I always enjoy our conversations. Can't wait till I actually see you in person again, hopefully soon.
It'll happen someday. Yeah.
And better yet, at a Reds game.
Oh, yeah. Hey, yeah.
They might make the playoffs this year.
You know what? Don't jinx them. Don't jinx them. It's... We'll see.
Yeah,
they actually have a few more games against the Cardinals coming up, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
So. Yeah, me too.
If they're there, maybe we can get together for one of those games. So that'd be awesome.
Perfect.
All right, buddy. Thanks, Peter. Have a great day.
All right. Take care, man.
Really great conversation there this week with Peter Margaritis. Peter is a renowned speaker, best-selling author, leadership expert, whose latest book is titled Off Script, Mastering the Art of Business Improv. You can get it today on Amazon and find out a whole lot more also by visiting petermargaritis.com. That's Peter, MargaritisIT.com. And don't forget, this week's sponsor is the Business Learning Institute, the BLI's Business Ready. Let me see if I can get that out. The BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And here we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPA. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. And that's it, gang. Have a great week. We'll talk to you again real soon.